Well, and that, and this sort of takes us back to what David was talking about earlier, trying different things, a writer doing different things in their career. You know, I always think you were talking about, well, maybe running out of gas on one idea and jumping to another one and keeping going. I think of it in terms of rotating crops. It takes a lot out of you to write a book, and maybe that little patch of the soil is exhausted, but you move on to something else, give it a chance to regenerate. Different things bubble up inside of you, so you find maybe when you've come back, you were saying how invigorating you found it to do totally new things for a year. I hope you'll find when you come back to it that that you've actually got a new enthusiasm, a fresh perspective on things you've done earlier.
I think that, you know, it very well might be the case. I did a book for Scholastic I just finished. They have this very popular young adult series called The 39 Clues. And they came about a year and a half ago and asked me to write the final book in the 39 Clues series. And it was this first series of like 12 books and different authors for each. And this last series was 6 books. And I had to wait for the first 5 to be written and sort of couldn't read them all, but sort of understood what was going on. And when Scholastic came to me and I said, well, you know, I'm an adult writer, not really a young adult writer. And she said, well, I've read other books where you had teenagers and all that, and you write the characters very well. I think you can do this. So I said, okay, well, let's get the ground rules straight. I can kill people, right? He goes, absolutely. You know, many people died in the 39 Clues. I said, great. Is there anyone I can't kill? She said, well, you know, the major characters, the Amy and Dan Cahill characters, we'd really like it if they could survive. You know, you can maim them, but as long as they survive. And I said, great. So writing that book, it was just totally different, writing to a different voice. I don't like writing down to young people. It's just right. that's wrong. It's stupid for a lot of different reasons. I'd rather let them rise up because I know that they can. I know they're super smart in a lot of ways. And, you know, the plotting and all that was a little bit different. The language is a little bit different. But it was still, look, at the bottom, whatever we do, it's still telling a story, regardless of what that story might be. And there are certain things that go into all stories at varying levels, characters and dialogue and a narrative and plots and subplots. But you just have to be able to spin that. And I tell you, you know, I trial lawyer for 10 years, great training ground for making things up. You know, being a lawyer is just super for that, because every day you were doing that in your life. But it's just at the end, it's telling a story.
Once again, we're talking with David Baldacci, 39 Clues. That's a pretty cool series. I really like it. Also, award-winning author, Catherine Neville, and Stash Hour. And we're here talking on the Authors Cafe. You were talking about, in general, talk a little bit more about development of characters.
Oh, development of characters. I let my characters develop themselves. Now, I use a lot of historic figures, as you know. And the only scary one I ever did was when I decided to write Magic Circle. I wanted to write a book about the coming millennium, the eon, really, the 2,000-year cycle, these huge cycles of history, the last one being, you know, the beginning of the Christian era. And so the book starts out in the last week in the life of Jesus. What's going on all over the world? What are the Druids doing in Brigantium? What are, you know, Pontius Pilate and the Hebrews and so forth doing in Judea? And it's set all over the planet, and it goes back and forth to 1989, which was the year of the Berlin Wall, the year of Tiananmen Square, and so forth. And I was really scared to death because I had, like, Hitler as a character. I had all these people running around in the 20th century. And I started reading about them, and I realized that with all the books that have been done about Jesus and all the books that have been done about Hitler, nobody ever used the material that was au courant, that they were reading themselves, that Hitler was reading himself. That, so I found out, who was Hitler's astrologer? Who was Hitler's priest who edited Mein Kampf for him when he was in prison? And it turns out that everybody was writing and keeping memoirs and stuff in the year 32 AD, just during the 3 years of Jesus's mission. So all the material was really there, but it just hadn't really been used in fiction or in nonfiction very much. So I got the minutes of the meetings of the Sanhedrin. It was really, no, they really kept
the. I hope their board meetings were more exciting than the board meetings at my condo.
they printed them out. They were all color copied and everything. It was really nice.
And so when you start surfacing all that little known administrivia from ancient times, it really gets very inspiring, and your characters just start running around doing things on their own. You know, you can have actual quotes coming right out of the mouth of Napoleon or Napoleon's grandmother, whatever.
David, do your characters write themselves?
Well, I think once you get into the story, they certainly will take you in a direction of their own mind. I hate reading books where characters are perfect with no flaws. You know, the handsome hero, the beautiful protagonist that with no skin blemishes at all, and nothing they do is ever wrong, and everything, all the motivations they have are pure and perfect, and the bad people are truly bad, with no redeeming values at all, and you know, and you really want them to die, and they do, and everybody's happy, and they feel good about themselves, and for me, that's just flawed characters. And so as I'm creating characters, both good and bad, I try to have some of my heroes do things that are questionable, or they question themselves about. I had another writer one time and said, you know, we both write the same sort of characters, except your characters cry about it later, mine don't. And I was like, yeah, you know, they do, because your characters are totally unrealistic. That's okay.
You have to tell us who that was.
Yeah, well, that'll be another time and place, Kim.
Off mic.
That's right, off mic. But I think you have to. Readers are flawed. You know, they have issues and problems in their life. And if you don't deliver a world to them that is full of those same issues, it just doesn't feel real. And the characters are really the only way that you have the vehicle in a book to connect one-on-one with your readers in a humanistic way. Because the rest of it's just plot and all that. That's fine. Or technical details. That's fine. But you're writing about a guy that uses heavy weaponry to kill people. Okay. You describe the weaponry. That's fine. And sort of the missions that go on. But why do they do this stuff? You know, what makes them tick? Why would you pick a job that no matter when you go in and do something, no matter what you do, whether you're successful or not, half the people will hate you and half the people will love you? Who would want a job like that for $75,000 a year, where you never see your family, you're traveling all over the world to these different hotspots? So you get into the head and hearts of the souls, and a lot of that comes through research as well. Then you sort of take that research and put that in the head and hearts of your characters, and all of a sudden you have very flawed people who are... It's like they're not killing machines, and they question orders they get. They question their own actions from time to time. They have family problems like everyone else, and they're trying to wonder, where do they fit in this big plan out there? And once you get down to that depth, and all of a sudden the one-dimensional character becomes two and sometimes three-dimensional. And for me, as the story goes on, they sort of fill out their own outlines themselves, because you really get to know them and you hear their dialogue in your heads and you're like, yeah, you're talking to them. And that's why you keep your door closed, so people don't won't put you on Prozac or something like that.
So Dan's writing nonfiction.
Yeah.
And the thing that is most amazing to me, I know we can't discuss his new book too much on this show because it isn't out yet, but the most amazing thing to me about what he's doing is that he's able to make these people seem like characters in a novel and make them really interesting. When I was first out on my first book tour, people would say to me, gosh, you make all these characters like Napoleon and Napoleon's mother and his sister and his grandmother and Catherine McGee. You make them all seem so real, so alive. And I'd say, well, they were. And there would be a pause, you know, on the microphone. And that's because a lot of history books and a lot of biographies just make them seem leaden, I think.
That's so right. It's just... so much of the history that you read when you were growing up, not all of it, of course, but so much of it was dry because it was almost handcuffed by its own reverence for the subjects. And I'm not saying that you should be disrespectful or that you should be dwelling on the seamier sides of historical figures, but it is possible to write about real people as if they were real people. And it's all there in their own words. I mean, so much of it is a question of getting them to sound like what they sounded like. And a real character emerges. It's exactly what David was talking about before. They start as one-dimensional because you're just looking at them through the lens of history and their achievements, whatever they may have been. But as you get a sense of what they sounded like from their own writings or from what people remembered them saying, talking about and doing, that adds another dimension. And then hopefully you get details that you can then fold into that brings a third dimension, so that you can really get people to understand in terms that make sense to them that a character like, to use your examples, Hitler, yeah. Jesus, or my examples, Conan Doyle, Poe, Alan Pinkerton, Abraham Lincoln, they were people. They lived. They did walk around at one point.
They ate lunch.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not necessarily just the big stone Lincoln sitting on the Washington Mall, but it was a person who was alive at a difficult time and made difficult choices. And if we understand what was going into some of those moments in their lives, we come closer to understanding them.
Just before Mary Lee Settle died, the National Book Award-winning great author, she was working on a book, and I was actually helping fund some research grants through Monticello and Virginia Foundation for her to keep going, and it was the young Thomas Jefferson. And I thought, what better person to think? No one really writes about him. You have like 12 seconds in every book about him, about his youth. And she was looking at the correspondence, and it just was fantastic, and she just didn't live to finish it. But boy, would I like to see that book.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, there was a whole biography series on famous people, but only wrote about their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And when they became 18 or 19 and they were on the cusp of what they would do for the rest of their lives, that's when the book ended. And because they were kids, they did lots of stupid things, and they did lots of things that I did when I was stupid and young, and maybe I'm still stupid and older. But you got the real person in those voices because they hadn't achieved the greatness yet. So really what you got was sort of some of the things that maybe led them to being great, but also a lot of the things that just led them to being kids. I really enjoyed those book series. I just snapped those up at the library, and it gave you the real people. I think probably one of the best character studies I've ever read, and this is a far more recent book, was Doris Kearns Goodwin, Team of Rivals,
mm-hmm.
where you really did get into the heads of that cabinet and Abraham Lincoln, and amazing. If politics is more complicated than that today, and maybe it will be, it's not by much, because that was like the most complicated cabinet configuration probably in history, and
really?
How Abraham Lincoln was able to figure it out and manipulate them to work together. I don't think it would be possible today, no matter if Lincoln were president or not, but it was, then you got to see the humanity behind all these quote-unquote historical figures that oftentimes you just see carved somewhere in marble or stone.
The interconnections of the people is what always fascinated me. And like in the eight, the entire panorama of these people, like Voltaire was writing letters to Catherine the Great and writing letters to Frederick the Great. And, you know, they all knew each other. They were running around together. I had one bubble chart for the fire where I had Lord Byron in England and then Lord Byron in Italy and then Lord Byron in Greece, and he was connected with all these different circles of people in different places, and then all those people were connected with other people, and it turns out that some of them were, I didn't even put this in the book, some of them were powwowing and translating early Greek Greek papyri and Greek texts and having meetings every night. And one of the people who went to that meeting was Mary Wollstonecraft. And it turns out that the guy who was translating all of the books, and Piranesi, the artist, went, the guy who was translating all the books, Thomas Taylor, the Platonist, had them. You know how they used to subscribe for books before they would be published? The waiting list included Thoreau and Emerson. And I thought, these people all knew each other. They all read each other's works. You know, it's just amazing. So,
I think that the difficult thing would be stopping the research and picking up my pen starting up my computer and actually starting to write.
Yeah.
Do you run into that?
We call it your research is showing.
I'm still researching books that were published 10 years ago. and that never stops, because the fact of writing the book then kicks up additional things. People write to you. You find out more interesting things. I mean, it never stops, and it shouldn't stop. It should stay alive. History should be alive. It should continue to evolve, and you're just contributing to an ongoing conversation.
You know, one night I was out in the kitchen baking cookies, barefoot in the kitchen, and I get this phone call like at 10 o'clock at night, and it's Sharon McCrum, the fabulous Southern mm-hmm. writer and mystery writer, and she said, "Catherine, I just want to know how you do it." And I said, "Do what? Bake cookies?" Yeah. And she said, no, she had started work on research on this book about Frankie Silver, the first woman who'd been hanged for murder in North Carolina or South Carolina. And while she was doing the research, she found out that she was remotely related to the character. I mean, it wasn't a character. It's a nonfiction book. Mm-hmm. No, maybe it was fiction. But at any rate, she got very, very embroiled in this. And she said, "And I just can't stop doing the research. It's just so fascinating." And I said, "Well, when's your deadline?" And she said, Monday morning, and this was Sunday. This was Sunday night, and I said, be careful. It's like a dangerous drug, Sharon. Put it down. Walk away from it. Mail the manuscript tomorrow morning.
You should have sent her down the cookies, too. That would have might have helped.
Give you some cookies, you know. It is like a dangerous
maybe
drug.
Maybe a pair of shoes.
Right, yeah. That's right.
It can get you very, very carried away.
Well, you know, research is like anything else. When you're writing fiction, less is best, and you got to leave 99% of it out because you're not writing a textbook. Otherwise, you write flip books. And I do this in my talk sometimes. I ask the audience, anybody here read a flip book? And nobody knows what the hell I'm talking about. And everybody keeps their hand down because they're like, what is a flip book? And I said, well, you've all read flip books because a flip book is where a writer has done a bunch of research, and he's very proud of it and doesn't want to leave any of it out. And he's like, but I don't want to integrate it, my God. So it's like, I'll just put it there, and you're reading it, and you're enjoying the story, and you hit this research, and you're like flip past the stuff to get back to the story, because again, you might read 1,000 pages, and talk to 12 people to have a few pages, and a few pieces of dialogue in the course of a novel, and that's all. Part of you feels like, oh my God, unbelievable. I had to distill it down to that. But you know what? It's far better to distill it down to that than to write a flip book that nobody's really going to enjoy. And Lincoln had a great quote. He would always write condolence letters to widows of the war. And he wrote one to a woman, very famous woman. She had lost 5 sons in the war. And his opening line was, I apologize for the length of this letter. If I'd had more time, it would have been far shorter and better. The greatest political speech of
really
all time
nice.
Was the Gettysburg Address, which was only 364 words long, that he was able to speak in 4 minutes, so short, in fact, that nobody in the audience knew that he had actually spoken, because they had a guy up, a congressman up, who spoke before him, who spoke for 2.5 hours, who remembers his speech. Nobody does. Everybody remembers the Gettysburg Address, but really brevity is better, because when you're researching and you stick it in for no other reason than to fill pages, and because, one, you don't have much of a story, and two, you're so proud of the research, you don't want to leave it out, you've written a bad book. You're dead from the start.
Yeah, we have a maxim in the fiction writing biz, when in doubt, leave it out. And I always say, whenever we have a panel or anything talking about, writing, what to do with your research, I always say, sort of the queen of self-indulgence when it comes to research. I will find ways that I can use it so that it will be interesting. But even then, I have this one maxim, which is if it doesn't serve to advance to develop the character or advance the plot, it doesn't belong in the book.
Yeah.
Unless you can find a brilliant hook, but it just doesn't belong in the book. Have to cut.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of many things I admire about your books. But too often you do come across what David would call a flip book. And I always equate it to, what if someone were writing a contemporary novel where a character gets into a car and they turn the ignition, and then the writer steps back to give you a couple of pages on the internal combustion engine? Well, that wouldn't be very interesting, and there's really no need for it. But the author has gone to the trouble to learn it, and they just feel you have to know that they know, and so they put it in. But if it's not working, it's enough just to get in the car and turn the key and drive. And if you can't do that, whether it's historical or whether it's contemporary, then your research is showing.
Yeah.
There is one thing, though, I have to say, and that is that I don't want to ever have a main character, because my main contemporary character always speaks in first person. It's first person. And so I try never to have a character who does a job or does something in that character's life that I haven't done myself. Because I found the research was too difficult for me to try to come up with. I could never write about someone who is a private detective or a forensics analyst or, attorney or whatever. Because I haven't done it, and it doesn't matter how much I would study it, I don't know how to say I did this or I did that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too tough.